Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're heading back, way back to the 1920s, Miami, Florida.
A place just booming, right?
Yep.
Sunshine, money flowing.
Exactly. But beneath that explosive growth, there was this hidden danger. We're diving into a case, a really chilling one, that makes you ask, how could something so evil operate right there, in plain sight, dressed up as, well, hospitality.
In the structure of this whole story, that's what's so compelling and frankly horrifying. The central image, the thing that drew people in, it was a hot air balloon.
Right. Offering these sightseeing flights seemed totally innocent, popular, even
sure.
High over the ocean, those, you know, teal waters.
Such a contrast, isn't it? This amazing spectacle, adventure, leisure. But it was masking this cold, calculated mechanism.
A deadly one.
Precisely. So our mission today isn't just to retell the legend of the operator, Philip D. Cupp. We need to really dissect the sources we have. We've got the investigators' records on one hand.
The careful notes, the facts as they recorded them.
Yes. Meticulous, cautious. And on the other hand, we have the folklore. The sensational story, the staggering figures that everyone remembers.
That's the real conflict, isn't it? We have the legend, the story that just erupted almost immediately, but then we also have these like structural notes from the investigators' own files. We need to compare those precise evidence-based bits.
Limited as they might be.
Right, limited. Compare them with the dramatic storytelling, those huge numbers that popped up seemingly overnight. How fast did the story inflate?
It's a classic case of what we sometimes call numbers that grow in the telling. The original facts, they're grounded, maybe even a bit dry, limited by what the authorities could actually confirm at the time.
Bureaucracy, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. But the public, they need a story that makes sense, something definitive, morally clear, and that allows these figures to just balloon, you could say.
Okay, poor choice of words, maybe.
Huh, maybe. But we need to look at the operation itself, how Cupp's business worked, how the deception was finally uncovered, and then really analyze why the legend, built on these almost unbelievable numbers, became so much bigger, so much more powerful than the crime they could actually prove.
So let's start there. The initial setup, this predatory thing hidden inside something that looked like pure fun. Hospitality, even.
Yeah.
Okay, so 1920s Miami, you said a boomtown. Cash everywhere, people coming and going. Anonymity was easy to find.
The perfect environment for someone like Cupp.
And his business, the hot air balloon rides, it was apparently a huge success. You have to picture it. Tourists rolling in, pockets full of cash, looking for thrills, maybe something to brag about back home.
Status symbol, definitely.
Yeah. And for a hefty fee, probably only affordable for the wealthy visitors passing through, you get into that wicker basket over teal water, you go way up, see the ocean, the city spreading out. For years, the sources say people saw this as just, you know, a cool, successful business, totally legit.
It's the perfect structure, physically and psychologically, for this kind of high-value predation disguised as a legitimate service. Think about the transaction itself.
It's isolating.
Completely. One client, maybe wealthy, physically cut off with the operator, miles above everyone, and critically, over deep water. Deep, unforgiving water.
So anything that happens.
Vanishes. Evidence, struggles, bodies. Immediately gone, permanently erased. The setting gave him total control. That physical isolation was his main defense. The beauty people paid for, the ocean, that was also the disposal method.
Clever, in a really dark way. But even the most perfect systems eventually show cracks, right? And the sources suggest the first hints started around 1925.
This is where the records start to matter. The official notebooks, they're cautious. They note that disappearances of tourists, seasonal residents, they reportedly surge around this time.
Just reportedly surge.
Yeah.
Not very dramatic.
No, it's bureaucratic language. Local police, probably swamped by all the new people, start noticing a weird number of folks come to Miami, have a good time, and then just vanish. No trace. This surge is the careful term they used. It justified taking a closer look.
But you have to remember the context of policing back then, especially in a place exploding like Miami.
Right. The police force just wasn't equipped for that flood of temporary visitors. Someone goes missing, someone who is only planning to stay a few weeks. That report takes time. Time to process, confirm it's real, maybe connect it to others.
It reminds me of that other case, the real Wendy one, where the records freeze, but life, or in this case, death, keeps moving.
That's a perfect comparison. The official paperwork, that note about a surge, it lags way behind the awful reality because the victims didn't have deep roots there. They were mobile, easy to miss initially.
And that gap, that lag, that's where the folklore rushes in, isn't it?
Yeah.
While the notebooks are carefully saying surge, the public story, the legend just blows it up. It becomes a specific, terrifying statistic.
Almost 500%.
Yeah, the disappearances had increased almost 500%. That number, 5 times the previous rate, that's way more powerful for storytelling than just noticing an upward trend. The public needed something huge, something almost impossible to grasp the crisis.
That 500% figure, it's like the public demanding an explanation that fits the fear, the chaos they felt. An increase that big doesn't just suggest a problem, it screams crisis. It points to something targeted, orchestrated, maybe by one very efficient person or group.
And when people looked around for something new, something high risk, something kind of unobserved happening.
Those private balloon flights over the deep ocean stood out, didn't they?
Connect the dots. The statistic demanded a monster, and Cuff's operation looked like the only thing that fit, operationally speaking.
Exactly. The numbers needed a source, and he provided the most logical, candidate based on the means and opportunity.
We should probably pause on just how well his operation was set up to avoid detection for so long. It really connects to that idea from like the Aladdin sources, where the system creates this false front. The treasure is usually a trap.
It's more than just a front here, though. The success of the business was part of the trap. He needed to be seen as successful, reputable, even expensive.
To attract the right kind of target.
Precisely. High-value tourists, people with cash, maybe traveling alone, people whose absence might not be immediately noticed back home. The visible success, the bustling business, that was the bait. It guaranteed the isolation and the trust he needed to, well, commit the crime.
So the system itself was designed to make money.
And generate corpses simultaneously. The success brought the victims, and the mechanism, the flight over the sea, ensured zero trace. His successful business provided the answer to that scary statistic.
But even with this elegant, horrifying setup, proving it was incredibly hard. Suspicion is one thing, evidence is another. They needed more than just rising numbers of anonymous missing people.
They needed a specific moment, a mechanism they could point to.
And that moment didn't come from adding up missing persons reports. It came from someone actually seeing something.
Right. The breakthrough wasn't statistical, it was visual, a direct witness report. That's what cracked Cup's system open and forced the authorities to shift from just analyzing trends to actually targeting him.
What do they see?
A local boater, just out, enjoying the day on the beach. And through his binoculars, apparently, he saw something awful, undeniable. A person, a man, falling from a hot air balloon, high up, way offshore.
Wow, just imagine that. Sitting on the beach, maybe watching the balloons because they were a spectacle.
Using binoculars on the beach, the sources emphasize that detail, and suddenly you see that, a human body falling, silently, because of the distance. Horrifying.
Did the boater try to help?
Immediately. Got in his boat, headed out toward the spot over those teal waters, but by the time he got anywhere near, far too late. The victim was gone, and just as importantly, the balloon itself was already heading back to shore, probably coming down slowly, normally not attracting attention.
So no mayday signal, nothing obviously wrong with the balloon itself.
Nothing apparent from a distance. But that specific testimony, seeing someone fall from the balloon, that forced the police to go talk to Cup right away.
And what did Cup say? He must have had an answer ready.
He did. The simplest, most obvious denial. He claimed he hadn't flown that day, hadn't given any rides, suggested the boater must have seen a balloon from another company.
Ah, the classic deflection. Blame the competition. In a busy place like Miami, maybe that could work.
He was counting on it, trying to muddy the waters, banking on the chaos of the boomtown. Figured it would be impossible to check hours later. Who could track balloon flights back then?
It seems like a standard, almost reflexive alibi in that kind of environment. Inject doubt, hope it goes away.
But the investigators saw through it almost instantly, not because they found debris or anything physical,
How then?
because of the unique nature of his business. This is where his own clever setup backfired.
How so?
Investigators checked licenses, equipment registries, local knowledge. They quickly realized Philip Cupp was the only person in the whole Miami area who owned and operated a hot air balloon for tourist flights like that.
Seriously? No competitors at all?
None. His simple denial, blaming another company, fell apart immediately. It proved he was lying.
So the very uniqueness that gave him control and isolation.
Also destroyed his alibi. It became the nail in his coffin, metaphorically speaking. Once they knew he lied about that, they knew they had their prime suspect. The question wasn't who anymore, it was how do we prove it? Especially when the main evidence, the bodies, kept disappearing into the sea.
That really highlights that theme, doesn't it? The danger of uncheckable alibis. His only worked if there was competition. Since there wasn't, the lie itself became evidence against him, pointed towards premeditation.
Absolutely. And that explains why they shifted tactics so drastically. Observation wasn't enough. The boater saw something, yes, but from too far away. No body, no physical proof tied directly to Cup. They had to get inside the operation.
Which meant a sting.
A very high-risk sting operation. They had to participate directly in the crime's mechanism to get undeniable proof. They couldn't rely on watching anymore.
That's a huge decision, putting an officer's life directly on the line like that.
It was enormous, weighing that risk against the danger Cup posed, especially with those disappearance numbers climbing. They felt they had to act, even if it meant sending someone up in that basket with him into that total isolation.
Yeah.
So with the alibi gone, they went for it, an incredibly aggressive plan. Audacious, really. And it all hinged on Cup believing he had just another rich tourist alone, ready for a ride.
They booked a solo flight, undercover.
Well, exactly. An officer, the sources name him as Officer Joffrey, went undercover, posing as a wealthy tourist wanting the full experience. The hope was to catch Cup literally in the act, maybe trying to force him out, maybe revealing the method somehow.
The tension must have been unbearable for Joffrey, for the team watching from shore.
Imagine it. They knew, or strongly suspected, Joffrey was going up kilometers above the ocean, totally alone, with a man they believed was a prolific serial killer. What backup could he possibly have?
What kind of signal could he even give? Any weapon he carried might be found in a pre-flight check.
It's terrifying to contemplate. The sources really emphasize how agonizing those first few minutes must have been for the watchers on shore. The balloon just rises smoothly, silently, high above the ocean. Everything looks completely normal.
Just a beautiful view, the coast getting smaller, the water turning that deep blue.
And the ascent itself, it's part of the psychological game, isn't it? Building trust, creating that absolute separation from the world below, the only sound up there breaking the silence.
The burner.
Yeah, that occasional burner hiss, the roar of the propane keeping them aloft, a reminder of who's in control. That sound, it just underscores the isolation the power Cup had up there. Joffrey must have been waiting, nerves shredded, for Cup to make his move.
And he did make a move.
Oh, yes. The silence was shattered. Violently. The sources pinpoint the moment Cup decided it was time. They're at altitude, miles out over the water. Cup leans in towards Officer Joffrey. And he delivers this line. It's become infamous. Part of the legend.
What did he say?
Just leaned in and said, "What goes up must go down."
Chilling. Just a statement of physics, but used as
a threat, a prophecy of murder, utterly cold. For Joffrey, that must have been it, the confirmation, but also the signal that he had to fight for his life right now.
So the sting worked in that sense. They got the confirmation.
They got the confirmation of intent, yes. But what happened next was catastrophic and probably not part of the plan.
A fight broke out up there.
A violent struggle, yes. Apparently visible from the shore. The backup team watched helplessly as the balloon starts shaking violently, swaying back and forth, a chaotic, terrifying sight against that huge sky. Joffrey wasn't just trying to survive. He was fighting back, trying to stop Cup for good.
And the outcome.
Tragic. The violence of the struggle, something went wrong. Maybe the burner controls got damaged. Maybe the basket structure itself. We don't know the specifics. But the balloon suddenly just plummeted straight into the sea below.
Oh no, both of them.
Neither man survived. A total tragedy. The plan to catch Cup red-handed sort of succeeded. They confirmed his deadly intent, but at the highest possible cost. Officer Joffrey's life and the loss of all the physical evidence.
So the sea, which Cup used to hide his crimes,
became the final vault, swallowed the balloon, the instrument of death, and both bodies. Cup was stopped, definitively. But the proof, gone, erased completely by the deep water.
And that lack of a neat ending, that erasure, that's what fed the legend.
Exactly. The facts stopped at the water surface. But the story, that was just getting started back on shore.
The investigation just ends.
Yeah.
Abruptly. Tragically. The final report has to state the facts. Suspect dead. Officer dead. Evidence gone. Lost to the sea.
The facts ended with that plunge. But this is exactly where the official conclusion splits dramatically from the horror that really took root in the public imagination. The legend.
This is where the numbers come back in, right? But bigger this time.
Much bigger. Remember, the initial notes only mentioned a surge back in 1925? Well, the folklore that grew out of this tragedy, it claimed something far more specific and staggering. It claimed investigators later attributed, wait for it, 400 plus disappearances to Philip D. Cup.
400 plus.
Yeah.
Just attributed.
Yes. We have to be really careful here. Reports say this. The folklore claims this number. It's not necessarily in those original cautious investigator notebooks from 25, but that number, 400 plus, its power, its persistence in the story, you just can't overstate it.
Over 400 victims from one guy in one balloon. It sounds almost impossible. It changes the whole scale, doesn't it? He goes from being a local predator to something else entirely.
An unprecedented figure of serial evil. It moves the story way beyond a standard crime, straight into myth territory. That sheer number, it's what cements the horror. It makes the story unforgettable.
Why that number, though? Why 400? Why did it need to be so huge?
Psychologically, maybe the public needed a number like 400. Think back, the initial shock was that 500% surge statistic. If it turned out Cup only killed, say, 5 or 10 people, would that justify the panic? Would it justify the high-risk sting, Joffrey's death? Maybe not, in the public mind.
So 400 makes the story fit. It makes the ending make sense.
It provides an explanation that matches the level of fear and the tragic climax. It allows people to imagine this fictional, horrific ledger of names, just row after row, documenting lives lost one by one. That number kind of stops further questions. It defines Cup as legendary evil. It perfectly fulfills that theme numbers that grow in the telling.
And it grew because there was no hard evidence left to contradict it.
Exactly. That ties back to our methodology points. The sting operation, meant to get proof, ended in tragedy. And crucially, the physical evidence that foundered the balloon, the basket, was erased by the sea. That created a vacuum.
And the number rushed in to fill it.
Precisely. That final dramatic erasure, it became part of the myth itself. Because there wasn't a neat conclusion, no trial, no wreckage examined, the lack of proof encouraged the figures to climb. The logic becomes, if he was so good at hiding it, if he was that evil, the number must be huge. There's nothing left to put a cap on it.
It's like that other theme we've seen. Like Klaus Richter, erasure becomes the evidence.
That's it, exactly. The sea took the physical proof, so the staggering number, 400 plus, it becomes the substitute evidence. It stands in for the scale of the crime. It's the number that refuses to go away, even if those original 1925 notebooks can't strictly prove it.
So the memory of the crime isn't really defined by the verifiable facts.
Right.
The boater, the failed alibi, Joffrey's bravery?
No. It's defined by the weight of that erased evidence and the horrifying number that sprung up to fill the void left behind. The beautiful wicker basket, the deadly mechanism gone. But the idea, the concept of the systematic predation, that took hold, solidified by that terrifying total.
The balloon went down.
But the ledger, in people's minds, just opened and never closed. Hashtag, tag, tag, tabula's outro.
Wow. Okay, this has been a really fascinating and deeply unsettling deep dive. We started with that contrast. The cautious police notes about a surge in disappearances.
The facts on paper.
Versus the folklore that screamed a 500% increase. The public story. And then we traced the investigation debunking Cup's alibi because he was the only operator.
The fatal flaw in his plan.
The incredible courage of Officer Joffrey going undercover. And that violent, tragic end midair.
And we showed how that clear, tragic structure, the sting, the struggle, the plunge, got completely overlaid, almost swallowed by the legend, by that spectacular claim of 400 plus victims.
That's a powerful lesson, isn't it? You have this unique crime mechanism combined with a sudden, violent, and erasing end.
The plunge into the sea.
And it just creates the perfect conditions for a legend to ignite and for the numbers to escalate way beyond what anyone could actually prove, defining the crime forever.
We really navigated that gap, I think, between the careful facts and the terrifying myth. Sometimes the legend becomes more powerful, more remembered than the verifiable truth of the crime.
It certainly feels that way here.
The sea took the balloon, but the numbers kept rising on shore.
So that leaves us, and you, with a final thought to chew on. When a system of predation manages to erase itself so completely, when the physical evidence is just gone forever, does the actual provable number of victims even matter as much as the symbolic number, like 400, that emerges to fill that void? Does that huge, horrifying number become necessary to make sure the crime itself is never forgotten? What stands out to you about how a single awful case transforms into an enduring, terrifying legend?